This download is made possible by all the generous folks who support public radio. If that includes you, thank you. If not, become a contributing member to your local station. And now, here's the show. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. The leaker and his lawyer this hour, Edward Snowden, has enlisted the ACLU to help him fight his legal battles with the U.S. government. We'll talk about whether his case is even winnable with Snowden advisor and ACLU legal eagle Ben Wisner. Also, is the Tea Party's brew a little weaker in 2014 than it was 4 years ago when it took down some legendary GOP incumbents and anointed some freshman renegades? We'll check in on Republican Congressman Eric Cantor's primary contest in Virginia today. But first, immigration reform, the recognized American crisis that never goes anywhere in Washington, D.C. Polling numbers suggest that the majority of Americans who believe there should be a path to citizenship for undocumented immigrants has held steady at a whopping 62% since the president was elected in 2008. But a new crisis has been developing. Other numbers show an influx of tens of thousands of women and children traveling from Central America and crossing the U.S.-Mexico border in recent months. It's a surge of single parents and children that has completely overwhelmed border agents and government officials who lack the resources or space to house the families. It's estimated that 74,000 unaccompanied minors will make that same journey by the end of this year. In just a minute, we'll talk to an Arizona mayor who is facing the tangible social impact of this influx. But first, we turn to Julia Preston, national immigration correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. Julia, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Hi, John. It's good to be here to talk to you about this important and very complicated issue.
Well, there's tension here. We've got a stalemate in Washington and apparent consensus among the public about the path to citizenship. And suddenly there's this influx from Central America. What do you think's going on?
Well, the influx from Central America has been building for quite a number of years now. The spearhead of this has been these young, unaccompanied minors who really have been making this incredibly dangerous journey. Often they travel across Mexico on the tops of trains, and this is now, since 2011, the numbers have been increasing and increasing, and now this year there's just been this huge surge in these numbers. In one sector, in the Rio Grande Valley of Texas, the unaccompanied minors alone are up 168% this year.
Now, that could either be an argument for increased border security and more aggressive deportation policy by the Obama administration, or it could be an argument for some kind of reform. Well, how do you think this is being received by the public and by lawmakers?
Well, I'm certain that Republicans in the House of Representatives will point to this as an example of lax border enforcement by the administration, and they may perhaps argue that this is another reason to put off any kind of legalization program until border security is more enforced. On the other side, you could make an argument that the bill that passed the Senate last year did have a huge plus up of funds and technology for increased border security, so that could be an argument on the other side.
You've been watching the immigration dynamics in this hemisphere for decades, and I'm wondering if the humanitarian dimension of what's going on from Central America right now resembles the, recall the boat people from Haiti who came in overwhelming numbers in the last century, and also the Cuban migrations that took place for political reasons as well as being a humanitarian problem as well.
Well, I would more compare it to 10 years ago, what it looked like at the border at San Diego when the Mexicans were coming across in such large numbers. This is a combination of push factors from the countries. There's been big increase in gang criminal violence in those three countries that are basically sending these migrants now. And the consolidation of the control of Mexican narcotic smugglers have really laid their hands on the human smuggling process through Mexico now. And so they're kind of feeding rumors as well about the prospects that these migrants might have of being able to stay in the United States. And then the fact that the system is overwhelmed on this side by the numbers. And these are children, in many cases, and women and families. They require different treatment than other migrants who are coming across the border in the past.
Is it fair to say, as some Republicans have said, that the administration may have contributed to this crisis by allowing Honduras and Guatemala to become so destabilized and by permitting Mexico to basically pass a problem that they're having north to us?
Well, I think part of the Republican argument is actually that on this side of the border, that large numbers of these migrants have been released into the United States. And this is, in fact, true. In fact, by law, for example, in the case of the children, the administration is required to attempt to find family members in the United States for these kids and to release them into out of detention into some kind of family custody if possible. So large numbers of these kids and the families have been released into the United States, and that has, I think, propelled a rumor and an image down in Central America that it is possible to come now to the United States and stay. I also think there's been a change in Mexico in the way that Mexico has been handling this. They've been much more willing to give transit to these migrants from Central America in recent years. So to that extent, I mean, I do think the Republicans are pointing to something that is true.
The Mexicans certainly have an interest in immigration reform in the United States. I'm wondering if, not to be too cynical, if the humanitarian dimension of this influx represents an opportunity for Democrats to push the Congress to act.
Well, I think that the Democrats are looking for anything they can. You know, the president has said that there's a 2-month window of opportunity now. So, and I think most of the groups that are advocating for immigration reform have also, by and large, accepted that timeline. We have 2 months now to put on a push for some action in the House that would create legislation that could match the bill that passed the Senate last year. The threat, of course, from the president, or at least as the Republicans see the threat, is that he will, if nothing happens, then he will have to take some kind of executive action to alleviate the deportations problem. So how this dynamic at the border is going to play into that debate on the Hill is really in the eye of the party that's making the argument.
Julia Preston, national immigration correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. Thanks so much, Julia.
Thank you.
Arturo Garino is the mayor of Nogales, Arizona. He joins us now. In his community, there are about 1,000 immigrant children transferred there by the Federal Department of Homeland Security. The children are being held in a makeshift detention center where the numbers are likely to rise in the coming months. Mayor, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
Has the federal government left you high and dry here in this, stalemate that's going on Capitol Hill?
Well, you know, there's so much to think about right now. The issue right now is basically humanitarian. We as a municipality, we're trying to assist Border Patrol the best we can. The Border Patrol station was turned into actually to a transition station so that they can process the children so they can be taken to other locations where they're going to be trying to locate family members. They've been working very hard to make sure that they have the medical facilities within the cafeterias and they're being taken care of the best that Border Patrol can do. They've been transferring kids like 200 to 300 in a rotation. So we're probably going to have this throughout the summer.
What's it look like at these detention centers when you go there? How heartbreaking is it to see just how this sense of being overwhelmed really looks on the ground?
Well, it is heartbreaking, like you say, John. And the thing is that yesterday I spoke to some of the children, and some of them are very sad. They haven't seen their parents. And you can imagine a child 10 years old, 12 years old, how they feel in a foreign country. So they're doing the best they can. The logistics of it is unbelievable. They brought in portable showers, portable laundromat. They are catering the food to them. AmeriCorps is helping out with the children. What I did notice is that the majority of the children, I would say 75%, are teenagers and boys.
Would you say that this whole process is pitting community versus community over these transfers and the federal government really trying to juggle these people around?
Well, that could happen. That could happen. But, you know, what we need to do is try to assist. That what we started doing on Friday, the community of Nogales got together, and the residents of Nogales said we had a clothing drive, because the majority of these children, are what they have is what they're wearing. So we've been helping Border Patrol. They accepted our clothing drive, and they're receiving the clothes as we speak, so that they can have some clothes to change on. But like I say, these children will probably stay here in a rotation within 4 to 5 days, and then they'll be sent somewhere else. So if there's 800 to 900 of them right now, that's probably the same amount that's going to be continuously until they process all the children, you know. And so the way I look at it, and the way the people I've talked to in Nogales and staff here at City Hall, is their concern is hopefully that when the children leave here and go to all these other places, they're taken care of as well as they're being taken care of here at the Border Patrol station.
Well, the cultural and the social implications of this influx we've been talking about, another argument for getting serious about immigration reform in Washington, D.C. Mayor Arturo Garino, mayor of Nogales, Arizona, thanks so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's been more than a year since Edward Snowden leaked information about NSA surveillance programs. That event has raised constitutional questions and technological questions about the conduct of U.S. government electronic espionage, questions of whether the law can ever keep up with communications technology, and whether the government can ever resist the temptation to use its technical capabilities that it acquires without establishing proper oversight. Now that legislation is working its way through Congress to regulate the NSA, a presidential directive to end certain NSA programs has come to pass, 2 Pulitzer Prizes for news organizations that published the Snowden documents, do the feds want to make a deal? There are reports of a channel of communications between federal prosecutors and Snowden's representatives. Discussions are said to have been underway for weeks. If anyone is in on those discussions, it's Snowden's principal legal advisor, Ben Wisner, from the ACLU. He told me he couldn't comment in any way on reports of any ongoing discussions, but I did ask him, could Snowden come in from the cold?
He will be back in the United States. He will not be back in the United States to face a trial under this regime. He'll be back in the United States when this administration or the next understands that the idea of locking away someone who launched a historic global debate is absurd. And will be, you know, viewed with astonishment and derision by the rest of the world. I really do think that Snowden is one of these characters who bent history. In general, history is kind to whistleblowers. History is much less kind to overbroad claims of national security. Dan Ellsberg walks around with a halo around his head right now, but what was said about him in 1971 made the criticism of Snowden seem like child play. He was getting his orders from the Soviet embassy. He was a traitor. The information that he released was going to cause grave and irreversible damage to national security. The playbook is the same. I really do think that Snowden is, and Ellsberg agrees, a far more consequential whistleblower than Ellsberg was. And so in time, I think the negative views of him are going to go away. Now, whether that means that in the near future there's a prospect of his returning to the United States, I really can't say. I hope you can get the Attorney General in this chair for the next conversation.
I sat down with Ben Wisner, legal counsel to Edward Snowden, at an event at the Core Club in Midtown Manhattan last night. And Wisner says that whether Snowden remains a fugitive in Russia or not, under current law, the government's case against him on one level is open and shut.
The only thing the government needs to show to lock Snowden away for life incommunicado is that he knew that the information that he disclosed to journalists was classified, and that he did it willfully. Everything else is completely irrelevant and inadmissible in a trial. There is no public interest defense. The government doesn't have to show that the information was properly classified. And that's why Edward Snowden believed, and I believe, that the smart move for him, if he wanted to contribute to this public debate, was to go not to a lawyer's office, but to an airport. And why the first time that he was able to actually speak to a lawyer was after he was, you know, already in the soup with a legal noose around his neck. So no, it doesn't complicate his legal case. It complicates his public case. But there'd be no public case at all if he hadn't done that, because on day one, he would have been put in a solitary confinement cell, and he would have been subjected to special administrative measures. He would not have been allowed to speak to the press. This isn't speculation. This is fact. Chelsea Manning, who was already convicted, is categorically prohibited from speaking to any reporter, from even sending a letter to a reporter, by the kinds of rules here. And what Edward Snowden knows dwarfs what she knows in terms of classified information.
Is it the case then, and based on your conversations with Edward Snowden, I wonder if this has come up, does he believe that the WikiLeaks Julian Assange approach to a much more discretionary method of leaking is invalid, and that he's basically sort of upgrading the quality, the veracity, the sort of intent of what he's doing versus WikiLeaks?
I would make two points about that. I think that sometimes what WikiLeaks did gets caricatured, because remember that WikiLeaks also worked with Der Spiegel, the New York Times, and The Guardian in a process to decide what would be published based on that log. So I think they later repudiated their own agreements with those organizations and decided that they didn't want to participate in a process that would involve that kind of vetting and the amount of redactions. But I don't need to tell you about my discussions with Snowden. I think you can observe his actions. He made a very clear decision that he was going to use a different model. And his model was going to allow journalists to lead rather than have him lead. He wants journalists to decide, again, using the processes that I outline, what's in the public interest, what the public should know or not know. He has said very candidly in some interviews, including with Time magazine, that he doesn't always agree with the decisions that these journalists are making on both sides. I think he's frustrated with how slow some of the journalism has been, and he's been frustrated by some of the articles the journalist chose to publish because what he thought he was providing for context they thought was the story. But he is comfortable with the process that he set up. It is a different one than the one that WikiLeaks now advocates. It is not to just put out massive amounts of information and, you know, sort of let the world process it and digest it how they will. It is for journalists to lead and make these decisions.
What do you think the principal constitutional issues are that so outraged Edward Snowden in the kinds of leaks that we've learned about over the last, the kinds of information we've gotten about programs at the NSA over the last year?
Well, here I think there's a very simple answer to this. You know, he believes, and I believe, that the Constitution essentially requires government surveillance to be targeted. It requires the suspicion to come first and the search to come second. And because the NSA's and not just the NSA's, but many governments' capabilities have grown so quickly, they've essentially flipped that around. Because they can now collect and store everything, they have come up with a legal regime that permits them to do that. So now they are arguing in cases in which we're litigating against them that the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution has nothing to say about the NSA intercepting and storing and as many communications of ours as it wants, as long as it just leaves it there in a box, in a digital box. The Constitution only potentially comes into play when a human being then queries that database in search of a particular, you know, subject or person. What NSA is doing in order to facilitate the mass collection of information that it does is that it's a laboratory for vulnerabilities. So it is both, you know, trying to undermine encryption systems that are widely used. It is trying to physically hack into these kinds of systems. It is installing malware and sending it over the open internet. So once you've done that, you have opened it up to China. You've opened it up to criminal hackers in Russia who are trying to get your credit card numbers. And that's why, I mean, technologists understand this. There is actually a conflict between surveillance and online security.
So we could just as easily be talking about Edward Snowden, the Chinese agent. I mean, if somebody infiltrated NSA who wanted to get access to this hardware, instead of leaks raising constitutional questions, it's perfectly possible that every bit of communications would be easily observed by a foreign power.
Well, and I think that is, you know, Keith Alexander, who ran the NSA until a few weeks ago, said that was his biggest fear. Because he knew so much about his own capabilities, he was terrified that China and other countries were up on our systems in the same way.
You raised something that's really, really interesting to me. Here we have the most, hopefully, vigilant and paranoid security experts in the world at the NSA trying to protect the United States. And they come to a crossroads technologically where they realize that they have a capability that they can install in hardware that will give them almost unlimited surveillance capability, but they also realize that that capability opens the door, essentially leaves unpadlocked the entire communications system of this country they're trying to protect. Is there any evidence that there were conversations at a high level in the government that people went, well, this might not be a great idea?
I don't know about evidence, but I know those conversations are taking place because the Department of Defense is also charged with cyber defense. And I have heard our national security officials testify to Congress that they believe that cybersecurity threats are a greater threat to the United States than terrorism. And I actually think many of them believe that. And if they believe that, then they are living with this tension that you just described, which is the tension between any intelligence agency's, you know, need and desire to accumulate as much information as it can, and their real fear that in doing so, they're facilitating other people doing that. So one way to think about it is, who benefits more from a regime that prioritizes offense, and who benefits more from a regime that prioritizes defense? What Edward Snowden has said, and I agree with him, is that the United States has the most to lose. Our intellectual property, our resources are worth more than other people's. And actually, Richard Clark, who was President Bush's terrorism advisor, testified in Congress last month, and he said the same thing. He said, it is more important that we protect our information from China than that we steal theirs. And that there is a tension between those two missions, and that we should be deploying more resources into cyber defense, even at the cost of our own offensive surveillance capabilities.
Speaking last night at the Core Club in Midtown Manhattan, Ben Wisner is the director of the ACLU's Speech, Privacy, and Technology Project. He's principal legal advisor to Edward Snowden. Pakistan is on the edge of something. The chronic chaos and unrest has erupted in violence in Pakistan's largest city, Karachi. Pakistani version of the Taliban have managed to shut down the international airport twice this week. Today, insurgents, possibly with no Taliban affiliation, attacked an airport training facility. The Pakistani military is fighting back 2 days after the five-hour siege and gun battle at the airport that killed dozens of people. The army has launched a deadly assault in the tribal area bordering Afghanistan, killing at least 15 militants. Declan Walsh joins me now. He's the Pakistan bureau chief for our partner, The New York Times. Declan, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Hi there.
So how serious is this attack, and is it a threat to Karachi or the national government?
Well, not as serious, certainly, as the attack on Sunday. It seems to be a relatively minor incident. Gunmen approached a security barrier just at the gates of a training facility just beside Karachi Airport this morning. They engaged the soldiers who were at the checkpost with fire, but nobody was hurt. And then the gunmen fled into an adjoining slum. So certainly nothing near as dramatic as the scenes in Karachi on Sunday evening when gunmen entered the airport facility and started a gunfight that went on through the night. But it has resulted again in the closure of the airport. That's Pakistan's largest airport, right in the center of the country's biggest city. So it certainly is having an impact.
Is there any sense that this is the beginning of an offensive against facilities in Pakistan, Karachi being just the beginning?
Well, it's important to say that in this latest attack, we don't know who the gunmen are, but obviously most suspicions are pointing to the Pakistani Taliban. And if you look at the recent attacks by the Pakistani Taliban in major cities like Karachi, there's a very strong sense that there is an escalation going on both sides, really. The government had been trying to engage the Taliban in peace talks since about February. That effort has pretty much effectively collapsed by now. And we are seeing on both sides attacks by both military and militants.
And again, the distinction between the Afghan Taliban and the Pakistani Taliban would suggest there's not a question of the Taliban deciding that it's actually more fertile ground for their movement inside Pakistan. These are two separate dynamics here.
That's right. Yeah, they are related organizations in that many members of the Pakistani Taliban had fought with the Afghans, particularly during the 1990s. But right now they're seen as being quite distinctive and they have separate goals. The Afghan Taliban aim to come to power in Kabul. The Pakistani Taliban aim to overthrow the government in Islamabad and to impose Sharia law on the country.
If we look more broadly in South Asia with the election of Mr. Modi in India and the historic invitation of the civilian leadership of Pakistan to the inauguration celebrations, I'm wondering if there's a sense that the civilian leadership in Pakistan is under some threat and vulnerability and needs to project its power right now, and the Taliban is trying to mess that up.
the civilian administration, you know, wants to reach some sort of resolution with the Taliban that doesn't involve a military operation in the tribal belt along the Afghan border, but their hand is being forced. The Taliban had a leadership split just a couple of weeks ago that made it appear that the movement was suddenly very weak, and then now they've come back with this attack on Sunday and perhaps another attack this morning to show that they're very much, if you like, alive and kicking. And in the political sense, this does leave the government, Nawaz Sharif as the prime minister, it leaves his government sort of politically vulnerable. It's a very uncertain time. And, you know, the election of Mr. Modi in India adds another factor to that, because, of course, Mr. Modi is certainly in Pakistan seen as a Hindu hardliner, someone who would potentially be aggressive towards Pakistan if a new dispute were to erupt between the two countries. So it all, in Pakistani terms, adds to the sense of uncertainty into the country, you know, on the political front, on the military front, and in dealing with the Taliban.
In a situation like this, does the civilian leadership grant more autonomy to the military? Does the military take more autonomy in dealing with the Pakistani Taliban? And does that complicate the political situation going forward?
It is difficult. There have been tensions between civilian and military leaders in recent months over just that, over how to deal with the Taliban. Mr. Sharif's government very much favours trying to reach a negotiated settlement, but the military seems to have been losing patience. They started military operations just a couple of weeks ago in the tribal belt. So there is a sense that the country's leaders are not entirely on the same page on this front yet. And, you know, their hand is being forced by these Taliban attacks.
And so far, everything is confined to Karachi. There's no sense that something's likely to happen in Islamabad or Peshawar.
Well, the violence at the moment is concentrated both in Karachi and hundreds of miles away in the tribal belt along the Afghan border. There have been attacks in recent months in Islamabad, in the capital, and that is always the danger when the Taliban start to assert themselves. One thing that they've shown in recent years is how their web of influence and supporters extends across the country. They have sleeper cells in many cities, and they may be, you know, they have shown in the past that they can activate people to carry out attacks against a wide variety of targets, civilian and military.
Declan Walsh is Pakistan bureau chief for our partner, The New York Times. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Where does the Tea Party movement stand right now nationally? Is it still the feared kingmaker, seniority breaker of 2010? There's a primary contest down in Virginia that may tell the tale. We'll talk about that in a few minutes. But polling data from the Pew Research Center finds that the percentage of Republicans who say they agree with the Tea Party has declined by as many as 15 percentage points, from more than half in 2010 to 36% today. And looking on the political map where that decline matters most may give us a hint of the 2016 presidential race. Joining us now is Dante Cheney, director of the American Communities Project at American University. Dante, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Well, thanks for having me, John.
So Tea Party, a weak brew these days?
Well, I mean, what's happened is when the Tea Party kind of arose in 2010, it was an unknown commodity. And I think there was a lot of just kind of anger at the general direction of the government. So a lot of people said they agreed with it in this Pew Research Center question. But when we look at those figures in 2014, what we're doing is we're taking the numbers over the course of the year. So this is through, obviously, May of 2014. The numbers are down. They're down across the board. And in the American Communities Project, they're down across the board in every one of the types we look at, and particularly down in some places that are very significant or will end up being, I think, very significant to the group as a whole.
All right. So in border states, in transition states, in swing communities, is that where this matters most?
Well, I think if you're a Tea Party candidate, you really had something that was a big part of your momentum in 2010 was you did well in evangelical places. And evangelical voters a lot of times they're kind of opposed to the establishment, the mainstream of the GOP. And the Tea Party to them, I think, in 2010 looked like a good place to go. So they had the highest percentage who said they agreed in 2010. Now, in 2014, the who agrees in these evangelical communities, evangelical hubs we call them, has dropped 17 percentage points, the most of any of the types that we look at in the American Communities Project. And that's really significant for a couple of reasons. First of all, those voters, particularly they are Republican primary voters. And this is where the Tea Party does its damage, right? This is where it does its damage. It's what we're talking about now in the primaries in 2014. And I think in 2016, these are the voters who come out. And if they're not big Tea Party supporters, I think for the movement, that becomes very problematic.
So for evangelicals, they're a group that's perennially looking for a new home within the GOP. They found it for a while with the Tea Party, and now they're on the hunt again. So what about people who have really been repudiated by the Tea Party and there's going to be no going back, who might maybe are back into the mainstream GOP?
Right. I think what you're looking at there is places in big suburbs, big, strong suburbs and cities and college towns. College towns are kind of interesting because the libertarian bent of the Tea Party, you think, might resonate with them. There are a lot of libertarians or college students. A lot of them say they've got a libertarian streak to them. But I think that some of the extremism may have pushed some of those people away. And what that means for the GOP, I think, in 2016 and maybe some in 2014, too, is that there are openings for these establishment candidates to do pretty well, or at least to, if you have a split within the party, there's enough there now that it is kind of leery of the Tea Party where the establishment does better, and that's what we're seeing. Ironically, the Tea Party could end up being good for the establishment of the GOP.
The mission of the establishment GOP is to try to expand its reach in Latino communities, in African-American communities. Does the Tea Party have any clout there?
No. In fact, it's really interesting. So it depends on how you measure it. I think that some of those Hispanic communities in particular, right, around the country, you do have a strong, very supportive part of the population for the Tea Party because they really don't like what's happening. I mean, if a lot of times if you live in a community with a lot of immigrants, a lot of Hispanics, it sometimes raises the tensions in those communities and it causes them to be more anti-immigrant, anti-immigration. But I think what's happened to the rest of those communities is they've really fallen away. And I think that when we looked at these numbers here, their numbers are very low for support in those Hispanic centers. Only about 19% of the people that live in them say they agree with the Tea Party.
All right, so the weakening Tea Party in 2014, we'll see what the numbers show by election time. Dante Cini is director of the American Communities Project at American University. Always great to talk to you, Dante. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, John.
Who exactly is Republican lawmaker Eric Cantor, the House Majority Leader? Is he a Tea Party radical, a reliable Obama contrarian who rallies the Republican far-right base? Or is he a member of the Republican establishment, the loyal number two to Speaker of the House John Boehner, a member of the leadership who can be relied on to keep the loud Tea Party wing of the GOP at bay? Cantor has always been a little cagey about his loyalties, but the people in his district in a primary election today in Richmond, Virginia, may out Cantor one way or another. Cantor is expected to win against little-known Tea Party favorite college professor David Bratt, but he has had to spend millions to do it. And the polls suggest that Cantor's incumbency may be the biggest strike he has against him right now. Jeff Shapiro is a political reporter and columnist for the Richmond Times-Dispatch. He joins us from Richmond. Jeff, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me.
So is Cantor going to be outed by his constituents as an establishment Republican, or will he be endorsed as a Tea Party plausible?
Eric Cantor will be comfortably renominated. This campaign now seems to be primarily about embarrassing the majority leader. I think one thing is clear to the voters in Virginia's 7th district, and that is Eric Cantor is in the power business, that his 14 years in Congress, more recent years as a member of the leadership, have been all about posturing, have been all about expanding his reach, and seem to have very little to do with delivering the goods for his district.
And why has he had to spend so much in this campaign?
Well, this is a politician who has generally been somewhat distant, somewhat aloof of his constituents. His press skills, I think it's fair to say, are somewhat limited. He prefers to engage his constituents his own way, and that means through direct mail and television advertising and social media.
I'm a little surprised by that. He's not a glad hander or a, you know, personal appearance congressman. He's only a 60-minute drive or so from Washington, D.C. I'm surprised he's so aloof. Why would that be?
He is an unusual character in several respects, one of which is he is the only Jewish Republican. And while that engenders a good deal of interest in him, it also engenders a good deal of suspicion. There is this sense that somehow a Jewish politician is supposed to embrace a particular punch list of issues. Also, this is a candidate who is running in a made-to-order district, one that has changed somewhat since he has taken over. the Tea Party impulse, the libertarian impulse, have become a lot stronger. And that has fed Mr. Kander's tendency to step back.
All right. So what's the margin going to mean for Kander going forward? Is there a number below which he really suffers?
The conventional wisdom seems to be that really anything under a 60% performance for Kander would qualify as an embarrassment. The folks who are organizing against him, the Tea Partiers, really seem intent on drawing blood.
And if they do draw blood with a below 60% performance, does that threaten his possible leadership role in the next Congress?
Well, that's going to be, of course, for others within his very restive House caucus in Washington to decide. There is no doubt that Mr. Kander is posturing for the speakership. The question is he the best face of the party? Is he most skilled in terms of his capacity to communicate a message? One of the things that he's been trying to do since the 2012 embarrassment for Republicans nationally is emphasize what I call kind of a relevance agenda. Talk about issues that are important to the everyday lives of voters. But as he's done that, he has only alienated this very restless Tea Party libertarian caucus and a lot of the talking heads on the fringes of the National Republican Party. One of the things that we have seen in this primary are lots of conservative Republican talking heads entering this campaign in behalf of David Brett.
Very interesting. Well, whatever happens today, there will be a fight over the leadership, and Kander is really in the crosshairs. Winning could be losing in some sense. Jeff Shapiro, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Jeff Shapiro is a political columnist for the Richmond Times-Dispatch. When wars are over or winding down, it's time to look at what to do with the surplus gear coming home from the battlefield. One of the Obama administration's approaches to the end of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan is not simply to have a huge garage sale on the open international arms market, but instead to give stuff away to needy local police departments. But what need does a 9-foot-tall, 30-ton tank fulfill for the local cops in Neenah, Wisconsin, or the town of Appleton right next door? Since 2006, American state and local law enforcement officials have acquired tanks and also M16 rifles, grenade launchers, silencers, large-caliber machine guns, and more. The pipeline includes 432 mine-resistant, ambush-protected armored vehicles, more than 93,000 machine guns, and nearly 200,000 ammunition magazines. The city councilman from Neenah, Bill Palno, joins me now. Bill, what do you need with a tank there in Neenah?
Well, it's my feel that there really was never demonstrated the need. It was more of the mindset that it was quote-unquote free, and it was available to be ascertained. So that's how it was proceeded originally.
Well, you know, you got a free tank. You can put it in the parade, you know, on Memorial Day, that sort of thing. Is there a lot of harm to that sort of thing, or does this concern you? Does this worry you?
Well, it is concerning. I guess we'll go back to, you know, the whole definition of free. I mean, this device that was built for the wars, it was originally cost the taxpayer $770,000, which kind of in this whole discussion has been lost in the shuffle. But it is concerning that, you know, that they use the mechanism as free, as that is a key selling point for even acquiring this, not so much the need. Because the need, I've been on the council for about 2 years now, we've never received any kind of correspondence from our police department, you know, quantifying or demonstrating that there was a safety concern or anything of that nature at all.
Of course, you know, the law enforcement officers in Columbine or, you know, Newtown in Connecticut had no advance warning of what happened at those schools. We've seen over the past many decades the growth of SWAT team capabilities in law enforcement around the country. Do you think there's a preventative function here of having this military and paramilitary equipment on hand?
In my opinion, you can always point to a worst-case scenario, you know, for justification of what you're doing. I mean, you know, I don't think there's ever been any nationwide study to demonstrate the impact negative and positive of the SWAT team growth in our country.
Maybe the tank is a little extreme, but what do you make of the rifles, the silencers, the machine guns, the armored vehicles? Do those and the ammunition, that's got to save some money if it's coming free from the feds.
Well, here's that word free again. It was paid for by the taxpayer originally. But, you know, the thing that's concerning is I go back to the processes and how do you want your government to be administered? Do you want a civilian oversight or do you want a police departments throughout the country basically being able to go direct and get what they claim and they feel is necessary? I think that's a kind of a dangerous road to go down when, you know, you have public officials and elected officials that people put there have no idea of what is happening right in their community.
So you'd rather have the federal government sell this on the open market and take the cash benefit and, you know, not make this pretense of it being free by giving it to local police departments?
No, not. I mean, I didn't mean that at all. You know, in wars gone past, what the federal government has done is put a lot of this equipment after World War II, after Korea, they put it in what they consider kind of a mothball situation to be utilized in need in the future. And if they don't need it, maybe they don't need it, then they part it out or they scrap it. But, I mean, I think that's two different items or two different issues as far as, you know, leftover surplus military hardware and local municipalities. I think those are two different distinct discussions, in my opinion.
Well, we interacted with your police chief there in Neenah, Kevin Wilkinson, and he had a few things to say about the rationale, not specifically for the tank, but just the changes that he's seen over 30 years in your community. He says, I've seen some pretty nasty deeds going on in big cities, in small towns, in rural homesteads. I've been wearing a ballistic vest anytime I'm on patrol. In 30 years, I've never needed it, not once, but I'd rather have it, referring to the vest and other equipment, than not need it, than need it and not have it, especially when you consider the price. My only desire in all of this is to be reasonable and to keep people safe. I believe that's my job. Is that a reasonable position for the police chief in Neenah to take?
Well, the police in our city does a fine knockdown job, I believe. And just to point to that, you know, we have a very, very low crime rate versus the state of Wisconsin. So they're doing a very well administered job. But I guess I would address that by saying, going back to the processes again, and all our other items, we go through a budget, we go through a vetting process, we have the elected officials very well involved with all our departments. So if, like I told the police department when this originally came up, I said, if there was a demonstrated need, what it costs, I would be supportive. I think that's a better way to do things.
Well, you know, you raise an interesting point because you found out about this almost by accident because you heard about what was going on in the neighboring town of Appleton and then discovered that, hey, you're going to get one too, one of these big tanks. Maybe you should ask if there are any surplus nuclear warheads coming your way. I mean, that'd be really nasty to keep in a warehouse somewhere, right?
Well, we could be facetious all day, I guess. I mean, but I understand your point. And that kind of leads to my next point. You know, when you talk about militarization and where the trends were going, you know, a lot of the militarization is perception. And that is always an underlying concern for me. The intangible is, what does our public feel about their police department? I want our public to trust our police department in the city of Neenah because they do an awesome job. They have a lot of great people. And something like this could maybe make people hesitant to call or not be engaging with the local police department. I think that would be a shame.
So there's a difference between the officer on the beat and, you know, a feeling of martial law. And that's what this really puts in play, in your view.
I wouldn't say martial law per se, but, this vehicle, by its very definition, is an article of war. So saying that there's some level of militarization in our local police department, I think is fair. What level or what percentage could be debated, but I think it's fair to say there is a certain level that the public has a perception now that is there.
Bill Paulno is the Neenah City Councilman. Thanks so much for talking to us. That's a great conversation.
Well, thank you for having me.
What do you think of Snowden and his lawyer's comments? If you want to catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything on the program, check us out at thetakeaway.org.
And tomorrow, our first book club conversation will be discussing Joshua Ferris's new book, To Rise Again at a Decent Hour. If you want to take part, and of course you will, call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE with your questions or comments about the book. Text the word book club to 69866. Again, that's book club to 69866. Talk to you tomorrow. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Reputation.com, encouraging everyone to check their online search results because search results define you or your business. Learn more at Reputation.com.